I'd like to start by acknowledging the Cammeraygal people as the traditional custodians of this land on which we meet today. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all First Nations that are here with us today, this evening. It's a privilege to welcome Bante Sujato with us here tonight. Bante Sujato Bikku. That is your name.
That is me, yeah.
Bante Sujato Bikku is a highly respected Australian Theravada Buddhist monk and scholar. Ordained in the Thai forest tradition in 1994, he has devoted his life to studying and teaching the earliest Buddhist scriptures, bringing this ancient wisdom to modern audiences like us. Bante Sujato is the founder of Sutta Central, an online resource of early Buddhist texts. Sutta Central is Bante's dedication to making these teachings accessible in modern times. Beyond his scholarship, Bante Sujato is known for his clear, compassionate, and insightful teachings on meditation. And tonight he will share this wisdom to help us find calm and clarity and a deeper understanding of the Dhamma. Thank you, Bante.
Thanks so much, Nina. That's very kind. Okay, so how are we all doing today? Everyone's doing good? That's what I want to hear. Excellent. Then I can retire. Nice. So a couple of people still just coming in, and so I'll just provide some filler as entertainment while they're going on. But I just came back from Indonesia. Yeah, it's very nice. Who's from Indonesia? Yay. Oh, we've got quite a few Indonesians here. Put your hands up again. Fabiola, you're from Indonesia? Why not? What's your connection with Indonesia?
I had to get out of Sydney or Australia because my visa, and I went and stayed in a female monastery.
Okay. Really?
Yes.
I'm going to have to ask you about that sometime. But
yeah,
okay.
I
don't be sorry. Be happy.
I have the non-sense.
Okay.
Oh, no, Indonesia,
that was
Thailand. I'm so sorry.
In the what? That's Thailand. That's Thailand. Okay, thank you for that. Thank you. Sadhu. Sadhu for that teaching. That was wonderful. Fine. Okay. Very good. Okay. So, yes, just been in Indonesia, which is, incidentally, has one of the oldest continuous Buddhist cultures of any country in the world, probably, possibly second only to India and Sri Lanka.
Yes.
Yeah. And even though Buddhism has had many vicissitudes over the years, but it's still flourishing there today. So I was there with a group called Ehi Pasiko. And Ehi Pasiko is actually, in my view, and I told this to them, is the best Buddhist group in the world. world's best Buddhist society. So I'm just throwing down the gauntlet there. Metta Center, you can got something to aspire to. BSWA, something to aspire to. Many, many good Buddhist groups around, but they've just done such an amazing job. And one of the reasons why, I mean, the main reason why is because of their leader, Andika, who, aka Uncle Singlet, who is an interesting character because he's very. Ehi Pasiko has a very bright, engaging, creative. Way of bringing Dhamma to people. They have a lot of artworks. They have a lot of cartoon characters. Like I've got my own cartoon avatar now of me wearing sunglasses. So apparently that's my thing now. And so he does all these things. But actually privately, Handika is quite his main love is translating Pali. He's actually translated more Pali Tripitaka than I have. And that's not often that I meet somebody who I can say that. So we would get out there and he'd like auction some artworks and things like that. And then when we'd sit on the plane together, we'd discuss like Pali terminology and things like that. So anyway, we got along really well, and it's a very joyful and creative and very sincere group who are really dedicated to bringing the early Buddhist teachings to people in a way that's really practical and accessible. So if you are in Indonesia, then look them up. They have groups in different places. Look them up. And one thing I did want to mention is that a project that they've been working on for some time and which is coming to fulfillment this year. Since then, we just had hands up for all the Indonesians in the audience. So there you go. You're belated, but anyway. Hopefully all of you know of Borobudur. Yes, people have heard of Borobudur. You've been there, a few people have been there. One of the most magnificent Buddhist sites, one of the most magnificent religious monuments of any kind anywhere, really. So the Borobudur, as we see it today, was reconstructed from the ruins. But as a stupa, it would have had a spire with a top on it. Like all the stupas have a spire, which is a top usually made of metal, maybe gold-plated with some umbrellas and different decorations and so on. And that's an essential component of any stupa. So because Borobudur is a living sacred site for Buddhism, not just an archaeological relic. So the Buddhist community, led by Hipasiko with the Indonesian Sangha and together with the archaeological department and the government, they're now going to rebuild the spire on Borobudur to recreate it. This is like a kind of a crowning thing. This is like what, like when you're building a stupa, like putting the spire on it is what makes it complete. It's like makes it active, if you know why. I guess it's like a lightning rod of the divine energy from whatever. Anyway, so we're going to put the spire on. And so they've actually already completed that. Handika designed it. They've already built it. And they're going to be installing that spire later in the year. So this is something that I think this is a really amazing project. And, of course, it's symbolic, but there are so many visitors to Borobudur. They'll see it and they'll know that this is a place that is part of a living Buddhist community in Indonesia. And it was also a sign of, I think particularly significant, a sign of commitment by the Indonesian government to supporting the Buddhist community in Indonesia. So I think that's really nice as well. So I just wanted to share that with you. So keep your eye out. I'm sure there'll be news about that and so on when it happens. I think September, maybe they were talking about installing it. Not this time, no. Yeah. They actually did a major Waisak. So I did the Waisak in Jakarta, and there was a huge one in Borobudur. I think they had like 100,000 people or something like that. I mean, it was massive.
So,
an
Indonesian family told me that every year,
yeah,
I can't remember which period, maybe Waisak period, where 1,000 monks will gather at Borobudur.
Right. That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Is that Waisak?
That probably is Waisak, yeah. Sorry? From all different traditions, yeah. So I just did a very small local Waisak in Jakarta. There's only like 2,500 people there. So there's a bit less than 1% of Indonesians identify as Buddhists. So, but because it's, of course, one of the world's most populous countries, it's still a lot of people, yeah. Yeah.
Bhante, I understand that Borobudur is on a very important ley line.
Okay.
Where it helps to, there's a lot of power, particularly Borobudur, where when people pray and meditate, it can amplify their progress. I mean, okay. That's what some traditions talk about.
Okay.
But I'd like to hear your insight on that, please.
I don't know. I heard the same thing, that there's one ley line going up on the east coast of Australia and another one going from the east to west, from Byron Bay to Shark Bay. And if you take magic mushrooms on the intersection of that, then that also is very powerful. I don't know. That's just what I heard. I don't know. That's what I heard. So I don't really know. Hopefully. Not that I ever did that. I didn't. No, seriously. I didn't. It's true, I didn't. I did, however, drive my car off the side of a road down a cliff on my way to doing that. But that's another story. That's another story. You don't want to hear about that. Okay, so looks like everybody's here. Let us begin with some chanting. If anybody needs chanting sheets, we can share them out. Do we have enough chanting sheets? Okay. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Close the door.
Thanks. I just don't want the other people in the centre complaining about the rowdy Buddhists. Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Dutiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Tatiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami. Iti piso bhagava raham sammā sambuddho vidya charana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati Svakato bhagavata dhammo Sandirtiko akaliko Ehipasiko opanayiko Pachatam veditamu minyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho Ujupatipanno bhagavato sahavakasangho Nyaya patipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Samichi patipanno bhagavato sahavaka sangho Yadidam chattari purisa yugani Attha purisa pungala Esa bhagavato sāvaka sangho Ahuneyo pahuneyo dakhyaneyo Anjali karaneyo Anuttaram punyaketa lokasati Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Maya, welcome. Looks like you just have to stand, Maya. That's okay. No, there's a chair over here. Maya is one of the most senior and respected people in Buddhism. We should, yes, that's right. We should stand for our elders. Yeah, sorry.
I'm really sorry I'm late.
Oh, we are very happy that you're here. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So, shall we do some meditation? Yes. Okay, very nice. Okay, very good. So, I'll say a few words to begin with. When we talk about meditation, we talk a lot about letting go. Hi, welcome. You're just in time. Excellent. Some more chairs. And maybe a bigger room next time. We have one here. Sorry for the folks online. I've got a couple of people coming in just in time. Well done, Sin Sin. Well done. Self-sacrifice.
Sorry.
Not at all. I'm very happy to see people coming. Yeah, of course. Excellent. All right. Okay, let's begin. So when we talk about meditation, we talk about letting go. Quick question, who knows how to let go?
No.
Yes? No? Yes. Come on. Come on. No. Come on. Little bit. Little bit. That's a start, right? That's a start. So, is it? Okay, really? So, so we talk a lot about letting go, and despite the somewhat disappointing reaction to that last question, I do believe that we actually do know how to let go. And I think probably most people in this room are being unnaturally modest in their responses because they probably do know something about what it's like to let go. In fact, I'm pretty sure that's the case because letting go, of course, is a normal part of life. And you can see just in a physical manifestation what happens when people can't do that. For example, someone who becomes a hoarder, right? It's a simple example. You can't let go of things from the past. And then your house fills up with rubbish and actually life becomes unlivable ultimately. So that's like a physical manifestation of that kind of extreme incapacity to be able to let go. So we do know how to let go and we practice letting go in our lives, but I think we know that letting go is a good thing and we've seen it in our meditation, but I think we often underestimate how powerful it is. Don't forget that letting go is one of the words the Buddha used for nibbana, right? It's not a small thing. It's a very, very powerful thing. And when we experience letting go in meditation, we experience it with a clarity and a precision that that shows us exactly like what the holding on is like, what the letting go is like, and what it is like afterwards. And you can actually see through the process of reflection, you can see at how the mind changes when you let go. And it's kind of astonishing because what happens in meditation, like sometimes when you let go, you let go of something that was bothering you, something that you were aware of, or maybe you're annoyed with somebody or something like that. And so then The mind has these thoughts which are unpleasant, and then you can let go of those thoughts and you can feel peaceful after, right? So that's a kind of letting go that we can all see. That's fine. But when letting go becomes more subtle, we end up letting go of things that we didn't even know we were holding on to. That's when letting go starts to get really interesting. You realize that there's a moment in your meditation where you let go, but you didn't realize you were holding on, actually. And then you let go, and then you realize that you're peaceful, but you didn't even realize that you were actually agitated beforehand. You realize the state of peace, and by comparison, you know, oh, beforehand, you were more tense, more holding on, but now, somehow, that's gone. You didn't even know it was there, and now it's gone. Yeah. So this is how letting go can manifest as we go deeper into meditation. We experience it in more subtle ways. So how do we do this? Trick question. Actually, to be honest, it was nice going to Indonesia and teaching people, because when I would ask them questions, unlike with you lot, like when I would ask them questions... They wouldn't realize that it was going to be a trick question, you see. So they just like give me a straight answer, and so that was really nice. So I forgot. And how do we do that moment of letting go? Well, we don't do that moment of letting go. That moment of letting go, in fact, happens when we stop doing. Right? Now, when that happens, then one of the natural tendencies is we then say, oh, how do I do it again? How do I get to that state of letting go again? And that tends to be that doesn't tend to sort of work all that well. Because now we're trying to get to something that came from a result of not trying to get to anything. So this is where, again, meditation becomes kind of interesting and kind of tricky. So how does that letting go happen? Well, one of the key ingredients is confidence. Yeah, is confidence. If we are scared, then we will hold on. And we can see this actually in our social life all the time. Right? The more that people are scared of things, the more that people hold on to things. And then that's why media and politicians and so on are constantly trying to scare people, because it makes people act irrationally and to hold on to things. And so in meditation, we want to relax all of those things. We want to feel confident. We want to feel happy. We want to feel at peace. We want to feel okay with whatever happens. Yeah? We want to feel okay with whatever happens. Whatever experience you go through, no matter what it is, it's just an experience. Whatever pain afflicts you, it's just pain. Whatever confusion or distress happens, it's just another experience, and it must be impermanent. And when we know this, not just as an idea, but when we know this in our experience, then we are okay with letting those things in. And when we are okay with letting suffering in, when we're okay to be vulnerable, when we're okay to burst down in tears. So Ajahn Chah said, you know, if you haven't cried in meditation, you haven't started practicing. Yeah? Because it's that moment of vulnerability. It's that moment where the mind is starting to open up, where the boundaries that we erect between the different parts of the mind are starting to dissolve, and those energies start to flow and start to move between, and we start to get a sense of balance and harmony and oneness in the whole mind. And that comes as an emotional transformation. I remember when in the 90s, back in the mid to late 90s, Ajahn Brahm started talking about breath meditation and samadhi as being emotional states. And this is something that was really quite new. Like if you knew how meditation was taught before that time, it really didn't sound like that at all. it was all much more cognitive, it's much more method, it's much more rational, it's much more scientific. And then Ajahn Brahm's like, well, you should hold your breath like it's your baby and love it like it's your baby. And it's such a different way of approaching meditation. It wants to not think about it in terms of, okay, I'm going to do step one, step two, step three, step four, but I'm going to do it in terms of finding that vulnerability that comes with letting go. And so we can't find that vulnerability unless we have that confidence. So this is why it's so important to develop the meditation, developing each step and stage of the meditation as we go, not because those steps make us get to that particular point, not because I'm going to do this step and then I'm going to do that step, I'm going to do that step and then I'm going to get to this meditation, but because doing those steps gives us the confidence that allow us to let go. And when we are able to let go, so we can't produce that letting go. We can't teach a method for letting go. We can just create an environment that means that when that letting go happens, that it is meaningful. That is the key. Actually, people let go all the time, but then they hold on, and then they let go, and then they hold on, and they can't really necessarily see the pattern there. They can't understand it. It's not meaningful. So when we put it in a meditation context, it becomes meaningful. Yeah. So each time when we sit to meditate.
Sorry, I need to let go in the bathroom. You,
please.
I'm sorry about that.
We did not need to not be, go.
I know, I'm sorry about that.
we don't need to know. Fine. All right. So when we experience that letting go in the meditation, rather than thinking, oh, there is that state of letting go, how do I get back to it? Then we think, oh, there was that experience of letting go that shows me that letting go is real. It shows me that those teachings are real. That's the important thing, okay? You're not going to get back to that state because that state is already in the past. Your mind has already changed. Whatever happens next time, it's going to be something different. So don't worry about that. We apply ourselves to those things that we can do. We practice with those things that we can do. We develop the meditation as we can, and we allow the letting go to come to us when it wants to, without forcing it, without pulling it, without pushing it, and without standing still. Yeah, that's the path of meditation. Okay, let's do some meditation. So sitting quietly. Letting the mind settle down inside your body. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in. Mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. and feeling the breath becoming ever more subtle. Bringing softness, bringing pleasure, bringing a lightness into your body and your mind. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Okay, now coming to the end of the meditation. And I want you to take a minute to reflect back over the meditation. Look at how it evolved from the beginning through to the middle to the end. What were those moments of letting go? When were those moments when your mind came to a peace all by itself? What was distracting? Like, where did you lose that letting go? What did you hold on to? Where did your mind go to? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. So let's have a bit of a break. Grab a cup of tea, stretch your legs, and then come back for some Dhamma talk.
Very nice. How's it going?
I'm falling asleep. I'm going home.
You're falling asleep?
Yeah. I'm going to let go of my ambition to be the best.
Reina, if you're falling asleep, you should go home. Please have my blessing and encouragement.
This is one of the main things I learned from Buddhism.
Right.
To be kind to myself.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Be happy.
Yeah, I'm going to Canada to my brother, to stay with my brother.
Oh, really?
4 months.
Okay, nice.
Of the lakes. I was going there because it was very cold in here, and I wanted to go to warmer climate. It's colder than in here. That's beautiful. 10 degrees at night, 17 during the day.
Not many people go from Australia to Canada for the warmth. But anyway, okay, I've got to get started. Okay. All right. Cheers. Okay, what are we doing? Oh, I already did that, right? Okay, everybody, come in. Rowini, just in time. How's it going?
Small house, but it's fine.
I know, right? I know.
I didn't mention it.
Oh, really? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Actually, I mentioned about that project to the Ehipausiko folks. So they're also interested in doing something like maybe doing a version or something like that once we've done it. So we can talk about that. But we also talked about whether, I don't know if Julian's got time, whether he could even stop off in Jakarta on the way home. Julian, right? Because he sent the score through when we were there. We were actually with one of the Ehipausiko people who's the piano teacher. So I'm like, showed it to her, and she's, oh, that's really hard, isn't it? And I'm like, okay. Great. That's so good. Okay. So, we're good? Now I know. So we're all gathered here today to listen to some Dhamma and to get that feeling of being uplift and so on. Hi, welcome. Oh, that's amazing. Make it, please come. We've got plenty of room. And
And I know, like, that things tend to be, you know, there's a lot of bad news and so on around. So I wanted to begin today with some good news so we can feel happy, right? Okay, so some good news. So first bit of good news I thought I'd say was, like, to rejoice in the comfort of our friends, who, especially scientists working in Antarctica. It's now winter in Antarctica. It's 15 degrees. Nice, isn't it? Isn't that good? You think it's nice and relaxing? 15 degrees in winter in Antarctica.
Celsius or Fahrenheit?
Celsius, and that's positive. That's plus 15 degrees. So it's not the reaction I was hoping for, but look. I mean, look, there are challenges. The world is facing challenges. I was just in Jakarta, and I did crack a few, like, snorkeling jokes, like, you know, just glad to be able to come back to Jakarta without having to use a snorkel, because it is sinking, and the government, so the government has a plan to relocate Jakarta. I mean, there's only 46 million people, so... Sorry? The Maldives are sinking. Yeah, there's a few places, right? So they'll have some company. Well, it's Bangkok, right? Good time to invest in snorkels. Good time to invest in snorkels. And look, I know.
Are they sinking or is it rising?
Both. Yeah, they're both. Yeah, they're sinking and it's rising. Yeah. I mean, it's a nice kind of synergy, you know, both going down. It is kind of balanced. And I know that, can I just a quick question, because I'm, as a monk, I don't use money. How's the economy going?
It's great.
Great, good. It's going good. I don't know. I feel like people struggle to have enough money to make ends meet, right? I just want you to know that, like, to rejoice that not everyone has those struggles. Like, Elon Musk is now $982 billion. I've not made his trillion yet. I mean, some of us have to have limits, right? And he made $12.8 billion in the last 24 hours. So we can rejoice, can't we? I thought I was bringing some good news for you all. He is, yeah, that's true.
And he doesn't pay for child support for all of his children, the ones that he officially accounts for as well.
Right. So this really isn't going the way that I thought. But look, I don't know, but also I think, I mean, another piece of good news which just came through yesterday was that for anybody who was afraid, like if you were worried that you might be cold in the upcoming summer here in Sydney, well, we're having a super El Nino now, so you won't have to worry about that. You know, we'll have plenty of warmth and bushfires to keep us warm and so on. So I just thought I'd, like, lift your spirits with a...
Thank you.
Anyhow, it's kind of just the way you look at it, isn't it? So we're here to talk about Buddhism and to practice Buddhism. And the number one, there's a thing with most religions, okay? Most religions have this thing that the world is good, right? Right? God created the world. It's a typical kind of narrative. God created the world. Boom, there it is. And it's good, right? And it's from the beginning of the Bible, he looked on the world, he said it was good. Same thing in, like, the Hindu religion and so on, and where the act of creation is something good and the world is supposed to be something good. There's a beautiful passage in the Upanishads, and many of you would know that, even though as a Buddhist I feel like formally required to condemn the Upanishads as being heretical, but in fact I quite like them. And this beautiful passage there where it talks about how everything is honey, and it says the eye is honey to and the ears of the honey of the sounds, and the sounds of the honey of the ears, and these things. It's called the Madhu Vija. It's really beautiful. You can see that, like, there's this perception of the world, that the world is something which is actually amazing, and it's beautiful, and you can live in this world as if everything is beautiful and wonderful, and there's a profound truth to that. There's a profound truth to that, and so we can adopt this, like that slightly unserious introduction that I gave was I remembered a song I heard many years ago about tobacco and big tobacco, and basically the lyrics went something like that. Yes, I know that somebody dies from cigarette smoking every 8 seconds, but let's not be too negative. Let's focus on the 7 seconds in between. Let's all focus on the positive. Right? And a lot of religious practice also is like that. So if you want to focus on the beautiful aspects of the world, there's something real about that, right? I mean, I'm just kind of joking around. But at the same time, there is something profoundly true about that. There's something profoundly true about the fact that this planet we have here is beautiful. It's incredible. And this life we have here is amazing. And we have, like, fresh water that, like, falls out of the sky. I mean, come on, you know. We have air. We can just breathe it. Like, how does that happen? And this world that we live in has got so many beautiful things, you know. And it's even this thing where, like, there's just plants and they have, like, flowers on them. It's just incredible. How does that happen? And they're so beautiful. And we can go around and we can see in the world that there are, like, puppies. And we're like... What did we do to deserve puppies, right? And there's so many things in the world which are actually genuinely like that. And it's not a matter of being like Pollyanna-ish or anything. This is a genuine and true and real and meaningful dimension of the world that we're living in. And so when a lot of people, you know, talk about, a lot of religious people talk about creation, talk about creation being inherently good, they're responding to that dimension of the world, it actually is real. There's something there. And we can't understand that without having some empathy for that point of view. Of course, the Buddha was a bit of a killjoy. I'm sorry. a bit of a wowser. So when the Upanishads were like, the eye is honey and the ear is honey and so on, the Buddha came along and said, the eye is fire and sights are fire. And the consciousness of those things is fire, and this is burning. And then your contact is fire, and your feelings are burning, and your desires for those things are burning, and everything around you is burning all the time. Sabbang aditang, the world is on fire. Yikes! Right? And of course, that's also pointing to a genuine and true aspect of the world, right? He gave that sermon, right? This is the comparison between those two ideas is not incidental. He gave that sermon on fire specifically to a group of Brahmanical rishis who had been studying that honey vidya. They knew that, right? That sermon on fire is actually not found anywhere else. The Buddha didn't go around just wandering around the streets and see someone enjoying their meal and say, I'm sorry, but that's just fire. Right? He didn't kind of do all that all the time. Right? He responded to a situation. That was a particular religious community who were practicing in that way. And then he pointed to another dimension of that reality. Of course, if you're in that, coming from a theistic point of view, right? Let's say you're a Christian or Hindu or whatever, then like these different religions, like Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and so on, they all see themselves as being quite distinct, right? They all have their own different traditions and they have their own different philosophies and so on and so forth. But from a Buddhist point of view, they're actually very similar. And the differences are somewhat minor. I mean, I was brought up as a Catholic and we kind of... I forget about it these days, but for a long time in Australia, the defining conflict was the Catholics versus the Anglicans. And when I was growing up, when I was a kid, and again, we forget about these things, right? When I was growing up in the 70s, if you said terrorist,
you thought IRA.
Yeah.
Right? That's who a terrorist was. It was a Catholic. And so that conflict between the Catholics and the Anglicans was like the defining conflict of everything, you know? And I mean, I grew up as a Catholic. My parents weren't fanatic. My parents were Australian, so they didn't really. We went to, I mean, they weren't particularly fanatical or anything like that. But some years ago, I went to an Anglican service for the first time, right? And as they did a, they actually did a, I don't know exactly what they call it, not quite an ordination, but anyway, they were introducing a new female priest in the local parish when I was in Perth, in Bodnyan, and we got an invitation to come down for that ceremony. So they came down and they just did the mass and so on. So that was the first time that I'd actually attended an Anglican service. And it was basically identical to a Catholic service. Like there was hardly any different. And I'm thinking, like, that's, these guys were at each other's throats for such a long time? Wild. So anyway, from a Buddhist point of view, sorry?
It's all about divorce.
It was all about divorce. And but then, we looked into our family history, like as an Australian kind of family, and like it's all like my mum was brought up as Anglican, but she converted to Catholic to marry my dad, who was Polish. Same sort of family, and it's all like that going way back, right? But then it doesn't take very long until you realise actually this, like my great grandparents were like probably not actually married, and all of these kinds of ambiguities which sort of sneak into things. We had another ancestor whose name was literally Mary Kelly, but she was listed as an Anglican. So there's something going on with that. Anyway, so from a Buddhist point of view, these are all variations on a theme, right? Where you can say, well, there are, you know, we can recognize that there are differences between those traditions, but from our point of view, they're all based on this idea we call eternalism, right? The eternalism is that there is some kind of reality that exists outside of space and time, outside of the idea of impermanence, something which exists literally forever. And when we listen to the religious speech of eternalist teachers, preachers, philosophers, and so on, then they will refer to this eternal principle in many different names and many different ways, but they will keep coming back to this eternal principle constantly. I was thinking a little bit about this because I was spent the last few days writing a response to the papal encyclical on AI, which hopefully you've all read. No? No? Anyone online? Anyone read it? Beyond, you read? No? It's a significant encyclical. Much of it you can bleep through, but there are some good bits on it. Anyway, I'm writing a response to it. Sorry? No. So I was kind of thinking about this because, like, thinking about the way that sort of he the Pope like refers things to this abstract realm of eternalism. And so that was what made that kind of prominent in my mind. So the Buddha, of course, rejected this kind of idea and rejected this kind of thinking. And it's kind of interesting for me that when, as a Buddhist, we approach issues, we don't really feel that need to refer things to some kind of other abstract realm. We can just discuss them as they are. So for the Buddha, this idea that things are eternal was based went beyond what could be realized through the senses. And I just want to dwell on that point just for a minute. So when the Buddha was talking about the eye being burning and sights being burning and ear being burning and so on, if we think about the nature of fire, right? Fire, obviously, well, it's painful, so there's that. But fire also is conditioned, and it requires fuel to burn. So unless we keep on fueling it, it will go out. Of course, this is one of the great metaphors for Nibbana, right? When the fire is no longer being fueled, then the fire will go out. And so this idea that all of these senses are burning is the idea that these things are being fueled, that they are being actively maintained. So this already is giving us a new way of looking at our experience. Because our experience is not just something that we happen to have.
I mean, that's how we see it, right? I mean, you just open your eyes and there the world is. And we don't really question that, right? So from a Buddhist point of view, these things are all conditioned, right? Conditioned, according to the Fire Sermon, by greed, hatred, and delusion, right? That's what creates these things. And in a technical sense, according to dependent origination, then we can say that the six senses are the means which we have created through our craving, right, in order to gratify ourselves. So because we want to have experiences, because we want to experience pleasure primarily, because we want to see nice things, so we cook up our eyes so we can see nice things. We want to hear nice sounds, so we cook up our ears so we can hear nice sounds. Right? We want to taste nice flavors, so we cook up our tongue. Right? That's how these things come to be. They're generated through our craving. Yeah? But underlying all of that, like even at a deeper level than the craving for these things, right, is simply the being. We don't just want to... We want to see nice things, right? But we'd rather see terrible things than nothing at all, right? So underlying that craving for pleasure, there's even a deeper craving, a craving to be, a craving for being. And it's at that point that Buddhism really departs from the theistic religions, because we don't see being as being something that is intrinsically positive. So this is something that's really foundational in a lot of theology. For example, Thomas Aquinas had this idea that if you want to argue for the existence of God, then God is that which possesses all good qualities, right? This is his argument, it's not my argument. God is that which possesses all good qualities, right? And the existence of good is necessary. So it's a necessary existence of all good qualities. Existence is better than non-existence. So God must possess the virtue of existence. Right? Now, I'm not going to try to defend that argument, and probably that argument doesn't sound all that persuasive to most people here. It's rather circular. But you can see how it leans on this idea of the inherent virtue, the inherent goodness of existence, the inherent goodness of being. Right? So from a Buddhist point of view, being is kind of neutral, if not actually, you know, not actually suffering. I mean, being is dukkha, right? But it just is. And so that is like a really radical challenge to that theistic approach to things, right? What does it even mean to say that, right? What does it even mean to say that? And like as Buddhists, it becomes very easy for us to say, oh, yes, we don't believe in God, and we believe in Nibbana and so on and so forth. We can say these things as ideas. But to face the reality of what it actually means is very challenging. Like, what do you actually mean? Like, Nibbana? What is Nibbana? Bhava Nirodho Nibbana. Nibbana is the ending of existence. It's kind of disturbing, isn't it? Right? It's kind of disturbing. And people see that, and then you want to say, it can't mean that or something like that. And then you have all of these other passages. And people quote the famous passage on Nibbana, Ati Bhikkhave Ajjatang Abhutang Akatang Asankatang. There exists the unborn, the unmade, the unbuilt, the uncreated. Right? So people say, oh, Nibbana isn't just non-existence. There is this thing. But it's a peculiar, that sentence is a peculiar candidate for affirming existence, because the Buddha is literally affirming a series of negatives. There is the unborn, the unbecome, the unproduced, the unmade. It's not all that reassuring. It's a little bit reassuring. It's not all that reassuring. And so Nibbana, the concept of Nibbana, is kind of scary. The Buddha actually talks about this, that even the gods would be scared when they hear about Nibbana. Yeah? Because they'd be like, that which we thought was eternal is not actually eternal. That which we thought was happiness, in fact, is suffering. And so even the gods will be scared. And he said, just like when the lion comes out of his den and roars and all of the animals in the jungle scatter in every direction, fleeing, pooping themselves in terror. That's what the gods are like when they hear the Buddha's teachings. So I think it's really important to understand this. You see, here's the thing. If the goal of our spiritual life was nice, it would become rapidly inadequate, okay? If we're talking about like clouds and cherubims with harps and these kinds of things, right? Oh, okay, we can get that. That's nice. On the other hand, harps, nice, okay? I don't know, how long are you going to listen to harp music for? Right? I mean, an hour, sure. A year? I'm going to be wanting some drums, you know? But I don't know if they got that in heaven. Like, but for literal eternity, literally ever and ever and ever, and all you get in is harp music, and then you're like, where are all my favorite musicians? And you're like, yeah, they're all downstairs. Yeah. I'm afraid. None of them made it. So this is the problem, right? You can, when you conceive it, and no matter how you conceive of heaven, like whatever you think, when you try to actually imagine the reality of it, it's just not, it can't live up to that. And so even the more, I mean, that's obviously kind of a childish idea of heaven, but even like more sophisticated ideas of heaven and so on, it's still, you know, even if you think of, say, the Brahma realms in Buddhism, you know, you practice jhana and then your mind becomes very pure. You get reborn in a realm which is nothing but light and bliss and stillness and clarity for like millions and millions of years. So it's great, right? It's amazing, yeah? To be able to live in that kind of way. But still it comes to an end because it's produced, so it's going to be impermanent. It doesn't matter how good it is, it always will come to an end. So this idea that no matter what you imagine that your goal of your spiritual life might be, the reality is never going to quite live up to that. So there's a phrase in the sutta, yena yena hi manyanti tatotam hoti anyata. I was in Indonesia, they asked me to give them a Dhamma quote to remember, so I told them that line. Yena yena hi manyanti tatotam hoti anyata. Whatever you think it is, turns out to be something else. Yeah? Whatever you think it is, it turns out to be something else. And it's not just that things don't meet your expectations, right? It's that the act of thinking about something is already changing it. Yeah? The act of thinking about it is already changing it. So if we're thinking about the goal of our spiritual life and the practice of Buddhism, the realization of Nibbana and all of these very profound things, by the time that that becomes a thought, it's already not the thing. And if we think that we have a satisfactory idea of what Nibbana is, that's just a thought. That's not a reality. And so, to my mind, it's actually good that Nibbana is kind of disturbing. And it's good that it's kind of uncomfortable. And it's good that you can't, like, 100% settle on a clear idea of it. Like, you know enough, but you can't necessarily know, you can't like really pin it down satisfactorily, because honestly, that's the death of a true spiritual path. If you think that you can lock it up and categorize it and define it, then you no longer have a spiritual path. Then you have the Abhidhamma. No, I'm only kidding. I'm only kidding. Of course, obviously, I'm only kidding. Where was I? Okay, fine. This is Alex's fault. He's the one who gave me that extra coffee before I came in. So the spiritual life should contain something which is mysterious, something which is surprising. And when the Buddha talked about Nibbana, he used a twofold approach. On the one hand, as I mentioned before, when he talked about Nibbana ontologically, he always talked about it as a cessation, as a negative, as something that doesn't exist, the cessation of consciousness, the cessation of being. But when he talked about the psychology of Nibbana, Nibbana is the haven. Nibbana is the Shivam, the grace. Nibbana is the refuge. Nibbana is Nibbanam Paramang Sukham. Nibbana is ultimate bliss. So when he talked about it emotionally, he wanted to draw us to it and to reassure us that Nibbana was something that was beautiful. Now, Buddhism has been around now for 2,500 years or so. I don't know of any records of any people attaining Nibbana and being unsatisfied with it. Okay? We have a high customer satisfaction rating as far as Nibbana is concerned, right? So how do we bridge that gap? Like, how do we bridge that gap between that slightly scary, or even not even really slightly scary? Actually, it's slightly scary if you think about it. But sometimes, like, if it's like dark, and you're in your room by yourself, and you're doing some meditation, and you kind of realize it can be actually like really terrifying. Anyway, how do we bridge that gap between where we are and where you're there? And that's what meditation is for. Why? Because the nature of Nibbana is letting go. And in meditation, we practice letting go. And so what we see when we meditate, and what each of us hopefully saw at least a little bit in that meditation we just did together, right, was letting go. Yeah? Right? Did we have some letting go? Yes. Okay. Most of us, at least a little bit. Right? And you see that letting go. That letting go is the same letting go of Nibbana. There's no different essence of it that makes Nibbana something else. Nibbana is just the continuation of that same process. And when the Buddha described that process of letting go in meditation, he used interesting similes. For example, he described it like a man being released from prison. Yeah. So that's what freedom is. Freedom is being released from prison. But then what is being released from prison like? Has anyone here been to prison? A few nods. Excellent. Not asking for anyone to disclose any personal information that they didn't necessarily want to. I've never been to prison, but my best friend John went to prison, and he told me that I should try it sometime. Well, actually, I brought him a copy of the Tao Te Ching when he was in prison, but the police stole it, so he never got it. So there was that. Anyway. One day I could, if you want, I can tell you the story of how he ended up in prison, which is a great story. That's like a really good story. But anyway, too long for just now. But his point was that you don't know freedom, you don't appreciate freedom until you're let out of prison, until it's taken away from you, and then you don't know what it's like. And I've met people who come out of prison. I used to be a busker. I used to play on the streets of King's Cross. And I remember this one time I was singing a song called Midnight Special, which is about a guy in prison who's longing to be let out of prison. And I was just singing the song. This guy comes along and he's just standing, a bit of a rough-looking guy and that, and then he just hears me singing and then just starts crying. And not like so many others, crying because of my singing. He's crying because of just that idea that he'd just come out of jail just that day. He'd just been released, and now he was out there and he's back in his life, and he didn't know what his life was. Like, what does it actually mean to be out of prison? What does it mean to be free? The fact that you're free doesn't actually tell you anything about who you are or what you're doing. It just tells you about what you're not. And so that idea of freedom, to my mind, is very rich because it encompasses so much potential. And one of the things that you can see in the Buddhist life to my mind, in the Buddhist life, is that those people who are more free are also more abundant. Like, I don't see people who are advanced in their spiritual practice, who are good meditators and so on and so forth, who are grim and small-minded and all of those things. I see people who are creative and full of life and able to bring meaning into all of the things that they do. And to me, this is the sign of somebody who's truly spiritually developed. So as we practice meditation, we let go a little bit, and we see that from that letting go a little bit, we have a little bit of happiness, a little bit of peace. And each stage as we go along in our meditation, we let go a little bit more. And each level of peace, we reflect back and we understand that that peace comes from letting go. This is so important. This is why we do the reflection at the end of every meditation, so we can look back and see, ah, that's where this peace came from. It came from letting go. Ah, and then you remind yourself again and again and again, holding on, suffering, letting go is peace. And the further we go in meditation, you will experience that many different times, countless different times, and you'll experience it in ways that where you'll have an experience of letting go, and you'll be like, that's incredible. That's so transformative, because letting go isn't a small thing. Letting go is incredibly transformative, and you'll reach a point in your meditation where you'll be like, that's everything is different now, because I've now seen what calm is. And that will be, your life will be then different from that point, because now you know that. You've experienced it, and nobody can take that away from you. But you keep on practicing, right? Maybe a year later, you have another experience and you're like, wow, that one that I had before, that was rubbish. This one, this is real peace now. Oh, sorry. Because letting go is so profound, and it transforms your mind from the roots, from the very basis of why it is that we have a mind, the very basis of why it is that we have senses. That's what we mean that we're doing when we're letting go of all of this craving, letting go of these akusala mula. And then when we let go, we realize that the world is no longer on fire. Yeah? And this is, of course, what we call nibbana, or extinguishment, or letting go of suffering. So there's a few words for you this evening on letting go and attachment. I offer that for your reflection. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And I'd like to invite any questions. Dana, please.
Yes, it reminded me when you were saying about the unmade and conditioned.
Right.
The retreat, uh-huh, and the sutta that you use.
Right.
The emptiness.
Right.
Which is a skillful means that gradually guide to this more and more empty state.
Exactly. Thanks, Dana. That's another angle at the same thing, right? So to look at it through emptiness and to see something is empty of something else. And again, each time it's giving us that confidence. This is really crucial. It's giving us that confidence. And so this is why we appreciate each letting go. Yeah. Thanks. Dana is another synonym for letting go, right?
Well, lately I feel I've let go of a lot of things and I feel lighter.
Your name's Dana Murthy, right? Murthy is Muti, which is also letting go. So you're like letting go, letting go.
How can I have to leave?
ABC conversation.
Okay, yeah.
There was a lady interviewed, and I can't remember the digital radio, and she started practicing meditation in prison.
Okay.
And she's done very, very well.
Ah, nice.
Really helped.
Ah, okay. So this one, ABC Conversations.
Conversations, and it was a couple of weeks ago, maybe.
Okay, so there's about meditation in the prison.
Yeah. Really good.
All right. Finding freedom in. And okay. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time, first of all.
No worries.
I've got a degree in counselling, and one thing I noticed about during that was how people might not turn up even to their first session that they've booked in with you,
right?
Because between kind of making the choice that they need to do something about, between deciding or realizing that they've got some sort of issue and they need to do something about it, then reaching out and finding an appropriate counselor,
right,
psychologist, things change for them.
Right.
And what you just said tonight, right, kind of put that in perspective for me and gave it a whole new angle.
Right.
So thank you for that. I just, science that backs up what you're.
So as a counselor, you're sitting there in your room like, nobody needs me anymore. And then you're like, does that mean that my own mental well-being is dependent on the mental unwell-being of others? But look, thanks for doing what you're doing. I think being a counselor and looking after people's mental health is a really beautiful job. So thank you for doing that. Okay. Got a couple. Yes. Interesting example. Interesting example. I'll just repeat that for the folks online. So the question was, what if letting go creates problems? And the example given was, what if you're addicted to smoking and you like smoking so much it gives you an escape? So if you were to let go of it, maybe it's going to save your life, but it's still not worth it. Okay? The challenging example, okay? I like it. That's good. Okay, so in that kind of case, I mean, the Buddha would always come back to choice, right? So ultimately, it's your choice about what you do. And, you know, we could look at somebody who's using cigarettes as a crutch like that. We could say, oh, that's an unskillful crutch or something like that. But the reality is that we all do things like that in one way or another, right? For somebody, it's maybe, I don't know, doom scrolling on their phone or zoning out in front of the telly or binge eating or whatever. And so we all actually do unwholesome things as crutches. And so from a Buddhist point of view, you know, maybe we want to move towards letting go of those things, right? But it's important to remember that coping mechanisms help us to cope, right? And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's perfect, but it does actually help to cope, and there's nothing wrong with coping. So the Buddhist path is not about saying, let's get rid of all the things that are helping us to cope. No. The Buddhist path is about using your wisdom and your mindfulness to identify, what are those things that are giving me suffering? And then we can start letting go of those things, yeah? And the things that, if there's something that you're doing, maybe you recognize, oh, I'd rather not be doing this, but it's actually not bringing me suffering right now. Okay, you can put that on the to-do list. It's okay. You don't have to let go of everything right all the time, but then focus on, what are those things that are actually leading to me suffering? Yeah? Is that okay? Makes sense? I'll come to you in a second, but the gentleman over here had a question first.
From what you've just said, as the poster boy for Buddhism, you've been obviously a monk for over 32 years. if you were trying to sell Buddhism to sort of newbies,
Okay. Look, you say that, you laugh, but I remember when the Buddhist community made a series of actual poster boy shots of themselves as a birthday present for Mei An. Do you remember that?
Oh, my goodness.
Do you remember that? You did a calendar. Yeah, you guys did a calendar back in the Mitra days. Remember that? You remember. Nilushi remembers. Like, you all did shots of yourselves and then put it together in a calendar as a birthday present?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you remember now, yeah. You remember. Fine, so if I'm not the poster boy, I'm saying Sinsin's the poster boy. But anyway, moving along. That doesn't help you at all.
I should qualify this. To me, you are the
that doesn't help. Okay, go on, please.
It's like being a junkie in terms of, you know, uh-huh, Buddhism. Uh-huh. But anyway, the what I was trying to
get at
is basically, I mean, obviously you remain in the practice because you've seen the progress. Right. Can I put it that way?
Okay.
So it you know, in terms of the encouragement,
uh-huh,
it's not so much just being studious about the Dhamma that's important,
right,
but it's really practicing Buddhism. It's basically,
right,
that mindfulness. It's,
right,
to try and get out of that conditioning that one.
Right.
Is that basically the essence? If I can, I mean, I'm just trying to sort of extract, you know, when you started getting, you know, I think you were
right,
in Japan,
right,
and
right,
then
right,
you went off to meditate and learn meditation in Thailand, and then that's how
something
you
like
developed
that,
your.
Something like
interest,
that, yeah. Something like that. There was also a kangaroo involved, but we. moving along.
But I
understand what you're saying. But yeah, that's true. You actually have to see you have to see what it's actually doing. You have to see the benefits of it. And I did it because I loved it, and because,
yeah,
I was finding so much joy, because I didn't understand what peace was before I started practicing. I didn't. It was just an idea. And then when you meditated, then you discovered that this is a reality. And so for me, once I'd done that, once I started down that road, it wasn't really a question, you know. It wasn't a question if I do this. The question was, how do you do it? And so, yeah, that was what led me to the path and what sustained me in the path since then.
But did you find that basically right in the beginning, the mind just rewires itself? There's that you know, that sila that comes in, and that,
right,
makes it, that pathway much easier.
Sure, yeah, yeah.
And it's more the practice than, I mean, I'm not trying to reduce down the Dhamma, but it, you know, you can read all you want, but it's not about the logic, it's more the...
It's the experience, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you again, Bhante, for your wonderful talk. I was trying not to ask another question because I know I can have a tendency to ask too much, but I couldn't help it because my heart really goes out to you, because all of us have our personal experiences with struggles. And one thing that I've learned, I mean, for myself, and hopefully others have learned as well, I'm sure, that when you have a particularly debilitating habit that you use as a coping mechanism, and you're able to shift your consciousness to a higher spiritual state, eventually hopefully to nirvana, then you can replace it with a more positive habit that can facilitate your coping mechanism and therefore help you liberate yourself from the samsaras of this world. So, for example, replacing smoking with meditation, that could be your new habit. So, I mean, I'll give a personal example of mine. It doesn't mean mine's unique or anything like that. I used to have really bad stress eating issues.
Mm.
And I've gotten therapy for it. I've gone on my weight loss journey with it. So I replaced eating food at night with reading Buddhist books.
A taste of Dhamma. Thank you.
With that being said, I still have a lot of imperfections, and I still stumble back on my little happy stomach.
Sadhu. Thank you so much for that. I'm just going to look at a couple of, if they've got a couple of comments online, see what they've got. 15 degrees, it's colder in Bundanoon than in Antarctica. Christelle says, Bhante, today is not dark week as far as I know. Yeah, it was bright week. Come on, Christelle. you see, the light only shines in the darkness. So by the time we get to dark week, then you'll really know that this was, in fact, the light week.
Which is the dark week?
Dark week is, what is it, the first Tuesday?
The first Friday. Friday after the first Tuesday.
That's right, yeah. Which I think is coming up in a couple of weeks. Yeah, I actually missed two of them because I've been away. So I've been holding in a dark week talk for such a long time. Yeah, 15 degrees. Yeah, in winter. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
My son
you can fact check.
For a job in Antarctica.
Yeah, you see, tell him to pack his bathers. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Can I? Okay. No. That's fine. That's fine. Oh no. There's one question online. Can I just take the question online because that was first, then we'll come back to that one. All right. And that will be the last question. So Colin from Belgium asked, Bande, is it no self or not self? Indeed, yes, Colin. Look, Colin, I know that some people like to argue that there's really a difference between this, but I don't really think there is. I think this is just semantics, and so I don't really pay much attention to that whole kind of debate. So I just thought, anyway, perhaps that's not the answer you're looking for, but anyway. Moving, yes, please.
Is last night I was reading up on the difference between mainstream spirituality and tantric spirituality.
Okay.
And I know tantric spirituality, when people say that they automatically
go okay, bye-bye. To the see you next more, time.
You know, sensual side of things, but that's not what I'm talking about.
Right.
When I was reading through what is tantric spirituality, what right. I understood was, it's life experience. It's what you go through. It is the intense. It could be facing something that has a lot of grief, etc. But you do learn and deepen your spirituality through that experience, as opposed to the mainstream spirituality, which is the ascetic way of doing it, which is renouncing and then going away and. And that has always been my challenge with Melissa, because there is a part of me that sits there thinking, but Buddha left his wife and child.
Right.
Why is no one talking about that?
The Buddha left his wife and child. Why is no one talking about that? Yeah.
Everyone goes sad, 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 but he didn't leave his wife and child.
We're judging.
We're judging. Okay, go on. Is that?
And that is one. That is my question. So how do we reconcile that?
Bloody hell. Okay. So this is.
Maybe for next week.
This is the kind of question which is It's not triggering. It's a good question. I don't want to dismiss it at all. It's a good question, a very important question, but probably not really. I don't know if I can deal with it satisfactorily in the few minutes we have remaining, because we have to have consideration for the staff here who also have to pack up and go home. But I will just say very briefly, at one point that you just said, it said, why is no one talking about that? So I don't think that's quite correct. Actually, because one of my hobbies is I study mythology. And I study the specifically the life of the Buddha and so on, as it's expressed in mythological terms, right? So one of the ideas of mythology you have was developed by Claude Lévi-Strauss, who talked about the way that story expresses dynamic and ambiguous and contradictory experiences that can't be logically sorted out. And it does that by creating points of tension, which are often then expressed in different ways through the storytelling technique. In Buddhism, that moment when the bodhisattva leaves his home is that primary nexus. It's the primary nexus in Buddhist storytelling. And it's told and retold hundreds of times. And every single time, it's different. And every single time that story is told, whether we're talking about the Buddha's own life, if you look at the retellings of the Buddha's own life in the different traditions and so on, they will all have similar kinds of ideas, but they will always handle that particular juncture slightly differently, right? Why? Because the Buddhist tradition was constantly worrying about it, because people were constantly thinking, what's actually going on with this, and finding a way of resolving it. But you can't ever 100% resolve it, because at the end of the day, there is a conflict between the world and renunciation. And so it's not something that we can reach a final point. I'll just give you one example of what I mean when I talk about resolving this in different ways. So there's one of the Jataka stories. So in the Jataka stories, there's 550 Jataka stories in Pali, hundreds in other traditions.
And many of those Jataka stories deal with the same moment. One of them, so this is a past life of the Buddha. So the Bodhisatta and his missus are sitting around the table having dinner, and the Bodhisatta says to his wife, darling, I just got something I want to share with you. She says, what is it, darling? And he says, I feel this spiritual calling. I'd really like to renounce and become a monk. And the wife says to him, oh, that's lovely, dear. She said, you know, I also felt that same calling. I'd also like to renounce and become a nun. And he says, well, we have our children who are still too young to look after themselves, so we maybe have to wait until they've grown up and then we can renounce. And she said, okay, that sounds like a good idea. So then later that evening, she says to her husband, darling, I just have to fetch some water from the well. So she goes outside and doesn't come back. Goes off and becomes a nun and leaves him looking after the kids. So he looked after the kids until they were old enough to look after themselves, and then he went and ordained, became a monk. Later on, as he was wandering around, he happened to run into his former wife, who has been now a renunciate for such a long time. Oh, hello, darling, how are you going? Did you ever manage to get that water from the well? So this is what I mean with that story is like told and retold in so many different ways, and there's no satisfactory way of resolving it, just as there's no satisfactory way of resolving your dilemma in thinking about that right now. You're thinking through that same dilemma, and that as long as we are here, then that will remain alive for us all. Yeah. So thanks, everyone. Wonderful to see you all here tonight. And as usual, just a reminder that on Tuesdays I'm at the 5 at 6. That's the Parramatta Library in Parramatta Square. So please come along and join that. That's at 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. I'm back here next Friday. Anything else happening?
Tenzin is running a one-day meditation retreat on Jitan Asana on the 4th of July.
Venerable Tenzin is running a one-day meditation retreat on Cittanupassana on the 4th of July, and that's through Metta Center? It's through Metta Center, okay, so please check Metta Center for that. Sutta Print Project. So we're doing a project for printing the translations of the suttas. This is for distribution in Australia. Details on that, we talked about that in some more detail some other time, but please grab the leaflet if you're interested in that and supporting that project. Anything else happening in the...
We're also going out
for dinner. Sadhu. So thanks, Pei, for organising and going out for dinner afterwards. Excellent. And just a kind of a bit of news that I've spoken with Deepika. We will be organising a retreat over December, the Christmas retreat. So we'll let you know when that's ready to start registration. And we also are thinking about doing another retreat in Fowler's Gap next year. We haven't confirmed that yet, but hopefully we'll think of doing that. So that's all we have for you today. Be happy. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.